And as mentioned, our leadoff guest is Stephen L. Carter, best-selling author of 14 books, including 8 works of nonfiction. His novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, spent 11 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. He's formerly a law clerk, for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and currently is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale University. He has taught there for more than 35 years, and his latest work is Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. And Stephen L. Carter, it is always a pleasure to talk with you, Dr. Carter.
Please call me Stephen. And Jim, it's a great pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me again.
Well, you have a personal connection to this great story. This lady, Eunice Carter, is no stranger to you.
Eunice Carter was my grandmother, my father's mother, and when I was growing up, I heard these faint stories about these fantastic things that she had done. But only much later, long after she died, did I discover that she had been the first black woman prosecutor in New York. She was a black woman, imagine that, prosecutor in New York City in the 1930s, and prosecuted mob figures, and including came up with a legal theory that put Lucky Luciano behind bars. She did a lot of other exciting things, too. She was an extraordinary woman. But telling her story has been something I've long wanted to do and worked on it for some years, and I'm very grateful that it's finally out.
How did the granddaughter of slaves graduate Smith College, cum laude, and then be accepted to Fordham Law School in the 1920s? How did this happen?
So Eunice's parents were big black activists of the day. Her father and mother both. They were both traveled the country, in fact, the world, in the cause of equality and freedom. And they inculcated in their two children a sense that they could do anything, that no barriers should hold them back. I'm not saying they didn't face any barriers. In fact, the family barely escaped the 1906 riot in Atlanta, which cost dozens, maybe hundreds of lives. But they inculcated in both of them this notion that nothing should hold them back and this notion that the most important thing was to educate themselves. And both children got very strong educations, in part because their parents pushed them so hard to do that.
Eunice Carter's story is an amazing one, and the book is Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. And the person we're speaking of is none other than Lucky Luciano. And how did Eunice Carter and Lucky Luciano come in contact?
Well, it's interesting that they actually both moved to New York around the same time, although they were little children. Her family grew from Atlanta and his from Italy, from Sicily. At roughly the same time, she moved to Brooklyn. He briefly to Brooklyn, then to Lower Manhattan. But by the mid-1930s, with New Yorkers getting fed up with organized crime, a special prosecutor for organized crime was appointed in New York. That was none other than Tom Dewey, who had run for president 3 times. And when he hired his 20 lawyers, none of whom could have any connection with the government before because he wanted no one who was corrupt, he hired 20 lawyers. They were known as 20 Against the Underworld, and it was 19 white males and 1 black woman. That was in August of 1935. So one has to picture that here he is, this powerful prosecutor. He became famous across the country instantly on his appointment. And as expected, his office is almost all white men, as you'd expect in the 1930s. And then this one black woman. And she was the outlier, if you will, in the office. But that's how she got involved in the effort to put Lucky Luciano, who was the most powerful mafia leader in the country and probably in history, the effort to put him behind bars.
Lucky Luciano was a pretty bad guy, wasn't he?
He was. He'd killed a lot of people on his way up, and people, even his own bosses, had a way of disappearing. But what's striking is that when the special prosecutor came to focus on Luciano, he wanted to convict him of something like loan sharking or murder or something like that, and it was too hard to find the evidence. It was Eunice, my grandmother, who came up with the idea of prosecuting Luciano for prostitution, for proving his connection with organized prostitution in New York. At first, that was an idea that everyone in the office was skeptical of, but she proved right, and that was actually the only crime that he was convicted of, and that's what sent him to prison.
It is interesting that Al Capone went to jail for tax evasion, and Lucky Luciano went to jail for prostitution. These mob kingpins were definitely hard targets at that time.
It was hard to get them for the things everybody knew they were doing, gambling, numbers running, murder, things like that, because the people who did those things tended to be very close-mouthed. You had to get them for something where there were records available, where there were other people involved who could tie them to the crime, which is what happened in the case of Al Capone and also happened in the case of Luciano.
877-217-5757, and of course we will get Professor Carter's take on the events of the last few weeks involving another Yale law product in Brett Kavanaugh. But before we get there, this fascinating story about his grandmother, Eunice Carter, is something to behold, and it's all written in beautiful glory and invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. Now, Eunice Carter flourished in the Harlem of the 20s and 30s, and even though we had rampant segregation in the United States, particularly in the South, but in other parts as well, including New York, the Harlem of the 20s was a place where a lot of magnificent things were happening. Women wore fancy hats, men wore colorful suits, and there was a rising black bourgeoisie. Was your grandmother part of this?
It wasn't exactly the way she was raised, but it was how she ended up. There were all kinds of social norms in Harlem, many of which we would now look on as quite destructive, that decided who got to rise to the top of society, who got invited to the right parties, and so on and so forth. And certainly my grandmother was part of that circle, but it was never as important to her as the work, as her work as a prosecutor first, and then many years later after she had left the DA's office, her work with the United Nations and with other international organizations was just as important to her. That was really what defined her, even though you're right, that in the 20s and 30s and really the 40s, that Harlem, in the midst of segregation, built this really quite magnificent society where people did thrive. They did travel abroad. They did do all sorts of wonderful things. So they built in Harlem a model, if you will, of what was closed to them in the larger segregated society that was New York of the time.
And you were raised in Harlem in the 50s and 60s.
I lived in Harlem when I was a little kid, although I moved to Washington when I was about 6 or 7. But I do have memories of Harlem of the 50s, although by that time, by the 50s, it was not quite as magnificent as it had been in the 30s and 40s, in part because the suburbs were starting to desegregate and black families, well-to-do families that at one point would have raised their children and spent their lives in Harlem, were moving to New Jersey and Long Island and so on. So Harlem was thinning out a little bit by then. But it was still quite wonderful, and you had these big mansions and these palatial townhouses and these magnificent apartments. It was really quite something to behold.
We're visiting with Yale Law Professor Stephen L. Carter, 35 years on that campus, and his book is about his grandmother. The raids were set for 9 p.m. and so secret that 160 New York City police officers were not allowed to open their orders until 5 minutes before the arrest. The targets were brothels, paying tribute to a name everyone knows, American mafioso Lucky Luciano. Few people know the name of Eunice Carter, the exceptional African-American lawyer who took him down. And we'll talk more about that and more when we return in 90 seconds with Stephen Carter. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and we're honored to share the microphone with Stephen L. Carter, distinguished law professor at Yale and also the author of 14 books. His latest is about his grandmother, Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. And a question from Holly at talk@talklouisiana.org about Thomas Dewey, the person who picked Eunice Carter, Stephen's grandmother, for his team of 20 lawyers at taking down, aimed at taking down Lucky Luciano. How did Dewey break with the ranks and choose a black female amid, I would suspect, 19 white male lawyers for this profound assignment?
Well, the first thing is you have to invert your thinking about politics a little bit, that in the 1920s and 1930s and really into the 40s, most black people in America voted Republican. That was the party of Lincoln. Lincoln had freed the slaves and so on. And interestingly, at that time, black people saw the Democratic Party as the party of the segregationist South, and so on and so on. And what was interesting about Dewey was he did actually have a strong commitment to civil rights. In fact, later on, when he ran for president, which he did in 1940, 44, and 48, 48 was the year that he famously lost to Truman after everyone thought went to bed the night before thinking that Dewey had won. When he ran for president, he actually ran on what was up to that time the strongest civil rights plank that any major party in the United States had ever had. It was really a remarkably powerful plank. It stands up well even today. And when he ran for president, or for that matter earlier when he ran for governor, he always talked about the many black appointments he had made and his black friends. He always talked about Eunice. She always campaigned for him. He always had her with him on the stump. He talked about how his family had had her over to dinner, which he said would never happen. He said in the White House, for example, he would say that no Democratic president would dare do that because they'd risk alienating their segregationist allies and so on and so on. So you have to put yourself in that mindset. It's a little topsy-turvy compared to the world we think of today, but that was really the world of that era. But you're right, even within that model, there was certainly a lot of segregation. The best evidence we have is that Dewey was looking for a woman. He wanted to get one woman out of the 20 staffers. How he came to settle on a black woman, history doesn't tell us, and Dewey himself told so many different stories about how he came to hire Eunice that we don't know exactly which one is true. But what we do know is that he was a Republican, she became a very prominent Republican, and certainly there was this party connection and connection in politics between them.
And it was about that time, 60 years after the Civil War, that many Republican African Americans became Democrats. What was the primary catalyst?
That's true. It's actually very interesting that in the 20s and 30s, you begin to see the black voters shifting slightly Democratic, and there was an interesting argument. So what happened was the Republicans kept saying, vote for us because we're the party of civil rights, which at the time was more or less true. The Democrats kept saying, vote for us because you'll have more money in your pocket, that we will have much better social programs, we'll have a much better economy. The Depression really made the big difference and shifted the black vote decisively into the Democratic column, because the Depression, of course, hit black people much harder than it hit white people, though it hit everybody hard. But the funny thing about that was that, in a sense, if you put it in today's terms, what the Democratic Party of the time was saying to black voters was, don't vote the divisive social issues, you know, like equal rights, but vote instead your pocketbook. That, ironically, was the message, and it worked.
And it worked. And now we're in a case in the South where this show is originating. In Louisiana, about 85% of the whites vote for Republicans and 95% of the blacks vote for Democrats. And it's hard for some people to believe that not so long ago, black people, for the most part, were Republicans in the United States.
It is hard to believe, but there are historical reasons for that. That is, the Republican Party was the party of civil rights, and that largely changed that calculus in the 60s and 70s, that by the time that Reagan took office, this shift had become very powerful and permanent in our politics. And incidentally, I should mention, I should have mentioned this before, my grandmother actually spent a year in Baton Rouge. She spent a year teaching at Southern University right out of college. That was her very first job before she went home to New York and decided to go to law school.
That's a great story. So Eunice Carter has a background right here in Baton Rouge, not so far from us right now. Now, as I stated, I've got to ask you about Brett Kavanaugh, and I suspect he may have even been a student of yours. What did you make of this episode as far as his confirmation process that came to a conclusion Saturday?
Well, the whole thing was very sad and brittle in a lot of ways. But I'll tell you something. I just wrote a piece about what my grandmother would have made of it, because she was a big Republican, as I said, at the time. But she was also a big campaigner for women's rights. In fact, she talked about what we now call sexual harassment in the workplace long before anybody was talking about that. She was giving speeches about that back in the 1930s. And I think that had my grandmother had a vote, so to speak, that originally she would have been all rah-rah for the nominee, because she was a good Republican, believed in the party, and didn't trust the Democrats, who she saw as the party of dirty tricks. That was her view. That was who she was. But as the substance of the charges became clear, whether or not she decided it was true, she would have certainly demanded a detailed and thorough investigation because of her concern for the rights of women, the rights of women in the workplace, the rights of women generally, again, back at a time when no one was talking about it. And I think that in the absence of that kind of thorough investigation, I think there's a good chance she would have changed sides. I think there's a good chance she would have ended up not supporting the nominee.
Do you know Justice Kavanaugh?
I believe that I had him as a student in a large lecture class way, way back in the late 80s, but I don't remember clearly.
And he has stated, and of course there are many who agree, and by the way, many prominent Democrats went to Yale Law School, including President Clinton and Hillary Clinton, yeah, and Jerry Brown. Go down the list. There certainly is many or more Democrats who went to Yale than Republicans. But he said it's the number one law school in America.
Well, I'll tell you, we do all right. You know, we do all right. But the thing is, I do think that one of the things that is attractive about Yale Law School is we do try to spend a lot of time inculcating in our students a sense of wonder and challenge about the world. What I hope that we and really all schools of higher learning will be able to do a little better, because we've had some problems on some campuses, is to try to make sure our students understand the importance of reason and argument in public debate, as opposed to slogans and shutting down debate and so on. It's so important in this uncivil age that we once again learn to reason about our differences and discuss them in an atmosphere of civility. And that's something to which I think we're dedicated at Yale, and I hope at all universities.
And lastly, Professor Carter, you worked for Thurgood Marshall. Is there a Supreme Court justice on the 9-member court right now who is in his league?
Well, Justice Marshall was one of the great justices and one of the great human beings I have ever known. I have so much affection for him. I got to know him very, very well after I worked for him, because I worked with him on his oral history for a year. I have so much affection for him. It really would be unfair for me to try to compare him with anyone else. But then I think he's really unique in American history. There's never been a justice, I think, who had the right set of experiences outside the court, had so much compassion on the court. Simply a wonderful human being.
Well, congratulations on your latest book. And this man is a prolific writer, in addition to being an outstanding professor at the number one law school in America, Yale University. Stephen Carter, he's been at Yale for 35 years, lives in Connecticut, and his latest book is Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. It's about his grandmother, Eunice Carter, taking down Lucky Luciano. Thank you so much, Dr. Carter.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for having me on.
Let's hope to do it again soon. You're quite a man. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we'll return after this time out and talk more about Justice Kavanaugh with Bob Mann if things go according to plan. But first, this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF.